Chapter 3, The Church. When I was a small boy growing up in South London, I was reminded every year of the Catholic conspiracy to blow up James I and his Parliament on the 5th of November 1605. Please to remember the 5th of November, gunpowder, treason and plot, we chanted at school on the anniversary of that day, and in the evening, as soon as it was dark, we burnt an effigy, or a guy, of Guy Fawkes on a bonfire in our backyards, and let off fireworks. The gunpowder plot must have left deep traces in the English folk memory, for us still to be celebrating Guy Fawkes Day, or Bonfire Night, as it was also called, more than 300 years after the event. It was as though we had always known about the plot and about how Guy Fawkes was surprised in the vaults below the Palace of Westminster with barrels of gunpowder and a lighted torch. There were other traces left by earlier events in English history in which Catholics or the Roman Catholic Church has played a sinister part. There was the Spanish Armada of 1588, which Philip II of Spain had launched with the object of dethroning Elizabeth, installing her Catholic cousin Mary, Queen of Scots, in her place, and, with the help of the Inquisition, returning England to the Catholic fold. We knew about the Great Armada and about how it had been defeated by Drake and the elements, not so much from our history lessons as from stories in the various boys' papers that were set in that period. Later, I learned about the Ridolfi plot, the aim of which was to assassinate Elizabeth, place Mary on the throne, bring about a general uprising of Catholics against the government, and restore Catholicism as the religion of the land. The plot had been sanctioned, in effect, by Pope Pius V's bull of 1570, in which he denounced Elizabeth as a heretic, excommunicated her, and absolved her subjects from all obedience to her. A subsequent directive from the Papal Secretary of State decreed that if any English gentleman were to undertake the glorious work of assassinating Queen Elizabeth, it would not be regarded as a sin. In the previous reign, that of Elizabeth's Catholic half-sister Mary I, there had taken place an event that probably left even deeper traces in the English folk memory than the gunpowder plot. This was the burning at the stake, as heretics, of nearly 300 Protestants of both sexes and all ages. Among the victims were Bishops Ridley and Latimer, and Archbishop Cranmer, who met their deaths in Oxford in 1555 and 1556, near the spot on which a memorial to them, erected in 1839, now stands. Latimer's last words to his colleague Ridley were, "Be of good cheer, Master Ridley, for I trust that this day we will light such a candle in England as by God's grace shall never be put out." I do not remember when I first read about the Ridolfi plot or about the burning of Protestants in the reign of Mary I, or Bloody Mary, as she came to be called, but I retain a distinct visual impression of two illustrations I saw, illustrations connected with two of the most horrifying episodes in European religious history. I came upon the first of these while still confined to bed, and I came upon it in the Children's Encyclopedia. It depicted a scene in the English embassy at the time of the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Eve, when, in 1572, in the course of a single week, 25,000 Huguenots, or French Protestants, were slaughtered in Paris and elsewhere in the country, on the orders of the French king, Charles IX. In the illustration, seven or eight men are gathered in front of a large window, their backs to the viewer. They are observing the carnage going on outside. To the right, an older man stands with hands clasped behind his back and head bowed, deep in thought. In the foreground, one woman bends solicitously over another, whose head is buried in the lap of a third woman. The second illustration occupied the front cover of a booklet I bought in Westminster Cathedral, on the occasion when my mother and I visited it with my Auntie Kate. The booklet was about the Spanish Inquisition, and the illustration depicted a single figure. He is carrying a lighted taper, and on his head there is a kind of dunce's cap inscribed with various symbols. His posture is extremely dejected. Apparently he is a reclaimed heretic doing public penance for his sins. The two illustrations must have affected me deeply for me to have retained visual images of them for so long. I must have felt the horror, the grief and the distress of those people in the English embassy, and have shared the dejection of the penitent. I certainly have a clear recollection of what I thought and felt when I read the booklet I had bought. The author did not seek to deny that the Inquisition had burnt people at the stake, which he could hardly have done without blushing. But he sought to excuse the Inquisition, to an extent, by maintaining that the total number of persons burnt had been greatly exaggerated by Protestant historians. It was not true, as they alleged, that altogether 80,000 persons had been burnt. It was only 30,000. To me, this quibbling over numbers was shockingly beside the point. It was horrible that anyone should be burnt at the stake. It was horrible that Catholics should kill Protestants, and that such killing should have the sanction, even the blessing, of the Pope, the head of the Roman Catholic Church. Later I discovered that the reigning Pope had struck a medal commemorating the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Eve, and that it was one of his predecessors who, in 1231 CE, had established the Inquisition, or Holy Office, as it was later styled, to suppress heresy. My feelings in this connection led me, in the next few years, to take an interest in the history of the Church. For me, the Church means the Roman Catholic Church. This is not because I believe the Roman Catholic Church to have a monopoly of Christian faith or Christian virtue, but because I am a European, and from 303 CE, when Constantine formally recognized Christianity as one of the religions legally permitted within the Roman Empire, to the 31st of October, 1517, when Martin Luther nailed his 95 Theses to the door of a church in Wittenberg. The history of Europe and the history of the Roman Catholic Church have been virtually inseparable. I did not study the subject systematically, but picked up knowledge about it in the course of my general reading, which at this time included John Addington Symonds' The Renaissance in Italy, Mandell Crichton's History of the Papacy, and biographies of Elizabeth I and Savonarola, all borrowed from the Tooting Public Library. I also learned something of the reign of Henry VIII, father of Mary I and Elizabeth I, in whose reign there took place the greatest upheaval in the religio-political history of England since the arrival of St. Augustine on these shores in 597 CE. Between 1532 and 1539, exasperated by the continued reluctance of Clement VII to grant him a divorce from Catherine of Aragon, who had failed to produce a male heir to the throne, Henry rejected the authority of the Pope, abolished annates to Rome, dissolved the monasteries, declared himself head of the Church in England, and married Anne Boleyn, the mother of the future Queen Elizabeth. This does not mean that from being Roman Catholic, England became Protestant all at once. Henry himself was theologically conservative, and more than one so-called heretic was burnt at the stake in his reign. Mary's four-year reign saw a violent swing from the Protestantism of her brother Edward VI, Henry's immediate successor, back to the Roman Catholic Church, the Pope's supremacy being restored, and Protestants persecuted. It was only during the long reign of Elizabeth, with her decided preference for the via media, that Protestantism in its moderate Anglican form became the predominant and official religion of the English people. But why was it necessary for Henry VIII to ask the Pope, more than 1,000 miles away in Rome, to grant him a divorce from Catherine of Aragon? And why was the Pope so reluctant to accede to his request? The short answer to the first question, I discovered, was that marriage and divorce, like so much else at the time, were matters that came within the jurisdiction of the Church, the supreme head of which was the Pope. To the second, that as ruler of the states of the Church, the vast stretch of territory that occupied much of central Italy, the Pope was subject to political and military pressure from other European rulers, especially at that time, from the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, whose troops had sacked Rome in 1527, and who, for reasons both personal and political, did not want Henry to get his divorce. But how had the Pope, how had the papacy, come to possess so much power, both spiritual and temporal? That was the question that now confronted me. But by the time I reached this point, Buddhism had begun to occupy the forefront of my consciousness, so it was only much later, after my return to England after spending 20 years in the East, that, conscious I was teaching the Dharma in a country still predominantly Christian, I picked up the threads of my old studies and gave some attention to Christianity, including the Church. Meanwhile, popes had come and popes had gone, and John XXIII and his Vatican Council had done their work. Much that hitherto had been deemed an essential part of the building had been dismantled, so that the nature of the Church's structure could now be more clearly discerned. Basically, the Roman Catholic Church was, or at least had been until recently, a spiritual come temporal kingdom, Christendom, of which the Pope was the king, possessing both spiritual and temporal power. It was not always so. Believing that Christ would soon return and establish his kingdom, the little Christian church in Rome, with its bishop, refused to take part in the civil and military life of the Roman state. Its members were accordingly proscribed and persecuted by the authorities and regarded as criminals by the rest of society. Being a Christian meant being ready to face death at any time. In 313 CE, all this changed. Constantine, the first Christian emperor of Rome, in that year recognized Christianity as one of the religions permitted within the Roman Empire. Nor was this all. The following year he gave to the then bishop of the Christian Church in Rome, Sylvester I, one of the imperial palaces to live in, an enormous amount of money, and much real estate, this becoming the occasion, 1,000 years later, of Dante's sorrowful reproach, as translated by Milton. Ah, Constantine, of how much ill was caused not thy conversion, but those rich domains that the first wealthy pope received of thee. The ill consisted in the fact that the patronage of Constantine transformed the bishop of the Christian Church in Rome into the pope, a temporal as well as a spiritual ruler, and his church into the Roman Catholic Church. Before long the church had its own government, the hierarchy, its own legal system, canon law, its own court, the hated ecclesiastical court of English history, its own fortresses and prisons, and eventually its own army. Sylvester's spiritual power was not bestowed on him by Constantine. It resided in the fact that as Bishop of Rome, he was the successor of the Apostle Peter, the first bishop, to whom Christ had said, "Thou art Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatsoever thou shalt bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatsoever thou shalt loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Matthew 16:18-19. It was by virtue of the spiritual power entrusted by Christ to St. Peter, and possessed by all Peter's successors as Bishop of Rome, that the Pope could excommunicate individuals and communities, and place whole kingdoms under an interdict. Pope Innocent III excommunicated King John and placed England under an interdict in 1208 CE, when John resisted his attempts to encroach upon the traditional right of the English crown in episcopal elections. Excommunication not only meant being expelled from the visible church on earth. By virtue of Christ's promise to Peter, it also meant being excluded from heaven. Under an interdict, the clergy were prohibited from administering the sacraments, and the dead could not be buried in consecrated ground. In the ages of faith, when men believed that outside the church there is no salvation, excommunication and interdict were formidable weapons, and the popes did not hesitate to employ them in support of their increasingly grandiose claims, whether spiritual or temporal. They were the means by which recalcitrant princes could be brought to heel, as King John eventually was. In Shakespeare's King John, there is a scene in which the king surrenders his crown to Cardinal Pandolf, the holy legate of the Pope, who hands it back to him in token of the fact that, as the legate says, John now holds his royal authority of the Pope, meaning that John is now the Pope's vassal. A few years ago, I attended a performance of King John at Stratford-upon-Avon, Shakespeare's birthplace, and was greatly struck by the way in which this scene was presented. Only Pandolf and the king were on stage. Pandolf, in his scarlet robes, was enthroned aloft, his head almost touching the ceiling, while John crouched below him in a posture of abject surrender. At this point in the production, I thought I felt a kind of frisson run through the audience, as if some members of it had been put in mind of the fact that 800 years after King John, the country might again have to give up its sovereignty, this time not to Rome, but to Brussels. When King John was first performed, sometime between 1591 and 1598, much more than a frisson must have passed through the audience. They must have remembered, with a surge of patriotic pride, the defeat of the Spanish Armada and the failure of Philip II's attempt to bring England back into the Roman Catholic Church by force of arms. Be that as it may, the scene from King John, as I saw it acted that evening, was a perfect representation of the blatant triumphalism of the medieval papacy, whose spiritual cum temporal power was at its height during the reign of Innocent III, before it was weakened by the Great Schism, when two, even three, rival popes cursed and excommunicated each other. Innocent III, 1198-1216, is in the line of Leo I, Gregory I, and Nicholas I, all of whom are styled the Great, because they had a high conception of the Pope's prerogatives and sought, with varying degrees of success, to act in accordance with it. Leo I, 440-461, laid down the doctrine that the bishops depended for the exercise of their jurisdiction on the Pope, who alone possessed the plenitude of power. Gregory I, 590-604, decreed that the Pope alone had the right to depose emperors and kings, that the Pope could absolve subjects from their oaths of loyalty, and that the Pope could be judged by no one. Nicholas I, 858-867, claimed the right to legislate for the whole of Christendom. In his view, the Pope was the supreme judge by whom all major disputes were to be judged, and who could accept appeals from lesser courts. These popes, more than any of the others, determined the basic mindset of the Roman Catholic Church for centuries to come. It was a mindset that was legalistic, intolerant, and authoritarian, and one that above all was bent on its own aggrandizement in the name of Christ. As late as 1864, when the papacy was about to lose what was left of the papal states, the then Pope, Pius IX, condemned as erroneous the opinion that, quote, "The Church has not the power of using force, nor has she any temporal power, direct or indirect." End of quote. When the devil tempted him in the wilderness, offering to give him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them, if he would fall down and worship him, Jesus had said, "Get thee hence, Satan," Matthew 4. 300 years later, when the devil appeared again in the benign form of the Emperor Constantine, Sylvester I did not treat him so rudely. He accepted the palace, the money, and the civil jurisdiction that were offered him, thus in effect falling down and worshipping the devil. The Pope, now a ruler among rulers, used his temporal power as ruler of the papal states in the interests of his spiritual authority. And his spiritual power as Bishop of Rome, the successor of St. Peter, in the interests of his and the Church's worldly power and prestige. Before long, the two powers and the two sets of interests were virtually indistinguishable, and the Church became a spiritual come temporal kingdom ruled by a Pope-King, who for a time was the most important ruler in Europe. Lord Acton, historian and Roman Catholic, wrote, "Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely." The papacy never quite possessed absolute power, though it strove to achieve it, but the corruption was nevertheless spectacular. I was therefore not surprised, especially after I had read about the Renaissance popes, to learn that there were Protestants who identified the papacy with the great whore seen by St. John the Divine in the Book of Revelation. Quote, "And I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-coloured beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet colour, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And on her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus." For those who saw the papacy as the great whore, the blood with which the woman was drunk was the blood of the Protestant martyrs, like those who had been burnt at the stake in the reign of Mary I, or who had died in the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Eve. That the Church was corrupt, inasmuch as it was based on power, did not mean that something of its original spirit did not survive within its massive structures. I am well aware that in every generation there were Catholics who led honourable and blameless lives, though the fact that they were members of the Church meant that they helped support, even if they did not directly contribute to, the general corruption. In recent times, this has been much less the case than it was formerly, there now being much less of the Church to support, so to speak, even in countries where the population is largely Catholic. Since 1870, when the papacy was shorn of its temporal power, and especially since Vatican II, papal authority has weighed less heavily on clergy and laity alike than at any time in the Church's history. Interdicts are unknown. While the formal excommunication of Marcel Lefebvre in 1988 for the unauthorized ordination of priests, the first excommunication within the Church for more than 100 years, was so exceptional as to be front-page news. One of the consequences of the Church's updating, as it has been called, is that Catholics are now free to enter into dialogue with the followers of other faiths, and even to learn about those faiths. In the course of the last 50 years, therefore, I have been able not only to read about the church, but also to have personal contact as a Buddhist with some of its more open-minded members. During my time in India, most of the Christians I got to know were missionaries. Kalimpong, a hill station in the foothills of the eastern Himalayas, where I lived for 14 years, was particularly rich in missionaries. There were the Scottish Presbyterians, who did their best to ignore me, the friendly American Seventh-day Adventists, who invited me to lunch, and the two missionary girls, fresh from Bible College in England, who, after their failure to convert me, regarded me with evident horror as one of the irretrievably lost. There were also the loners, such as the saintly American member of the Cowley Fathers, an Anglican religious order, who loved lepers and scandalized his fellow missionaries by refusing to convert anyone, and the bumptious, red-bearded Scottish evangelist who belonged to no Christian body and who, quote, took his orders direct from God. And there were the Roman Catholics. The Catholics were the mainly Swiss priests and brothers at St. Augustine's Priory, and the nuns, some of them Indian, at St. Philomena's Convent nearby. The former conducted a boarding school for boys, the latter a boarding school for girls. Each had built their own church. The priests and brothers had constructed theirs on the model of a Tibetan gompa, while the nuns had opted for something vaguely Gothic with stained glass windows. Some of the brothers got into the habit of visiting me, as the rented building in which I was then living was situated halfway between the priory and the bazaar, and it was easy for them to drop in on their way to market. I returned their visits, and in this way got to know some of them quite well. I lent them books on Buddhism and borrowed Christian classics from the priory library, and we had long and interesting discussions on Buddhism, comparative religion, and mysticism. This friendly contact, which took place in the early 1950s, did not continue for more than 2 or 3 months. The brothers suddenly stopped coming to see me, and when I happened to meet them on the road, they seemed embarrassed. Much later I learned that someone in authority had forbidden them to have anything more to do with me. A year or two later I met a Roman Catholic of a very different kind from whoever it was had told the Augustinian brothers that they were to stop seeing me. This was a little gnome-like, bright-eyed French priest called Father Monchanin, one of the founders of the first Christian ashrams in India, and thus a forerunner of the better-known Father Bede Griffiths, whose autobiography, The Golden String, I read some years later. I met Father Monchanin not in Kalimpong but in Bangalore at the Indian Institute of Culture, where for 2 hours or more we discussed Buddhism, especially the Madhyamika Vada, Vedanta, and comparative mysticism. I would have liked to see more of Father Monchanin, but our paths did not cross again, though we exchanged a few letters, and not many years after our meeting, he died. At about the same time, I made the acquaintance of two other Catholic priests, with one of whom I was to be in fairly regular contact for the rest of my time in India. I met both of them in Bombay at the home of my Parsi friend Dinshaw Mehta, founder of the Society of Servants of God, with whom I often stayed when I was lecturing in that cosmopolitan city. Father Mascarenhas, a Goanese by birth, was a large, cheerful, communicative man in his mid-50s, with an enormous paunch that threatened to burst the buttons on his tightly stretched white soutane. A very learned man, the master of many languages, his views on Indian Catholicism, or rather on Catholicism in India, were very much in accord with Father Monchanin's. He believed that the church had to become culturally much more Indian. In particular, he believed that, just as in Europe, Catholic theology, in the person of St. Thomas Aquinas, had absorbed and Christianized the philosophy of Aristotle, so in India it had to absorb and Christianize the philosophy of Shankara. and since I had studied the works of the great exponent of Advaita Vedanta, and since I had studied the works of the great exponent of Advaita Vedanta, we had some interesting discussions. Father Mascarenhas also believed that the three magi, who in the Gospel according to St. Matthew present the infant Jesus with gold, frankincense and myrrh, all came from Western India, possibly from Goa. Not surprisingly, he was often in trouble with his ecclesiastical superiors for his views on the Indianization of the Church, and more than once had to appear before the Archbishop to receive a warning or a reprimand. For a period he had even been suspended from the exercise of his priestly functions, though for precisely what offence he did not say. All this was as water off a duck's back, however, and among his non-Christian friends, at least, he continued to air his unorthodox views, as well as to denounce what he called the Roman racket, in unsparing terms. Once he told me that he hated Christmas. He hated it because it was in the week before Christmas Day that many Bombay Catholics made their annual confession, and he was obliged to sit for hours on end listening to the same dreary catalogue of petty sins, until he felt thoroughly nauseated. Later on, Father Mascarenhas may have had sins of his own to confess. The last time I had news of him, on a return visit to India, he had moved to Pune and was living with a woman. The other priest I met only once. I do not remember his name, but I well remember his story. We met at the suggestion of my theosophist friend Sophia Wadia, editor of the Aryan Path, who told me that the priest was in a state of great mental distress and might, she thought, find it helpful to talk to me. He came accompanied by an armed bodyguard in the form of two senior police officers who stationed themselves in the hallway while we talked privately in my room. He was an ex-Jesuit, he explained, and until recently had been professor of philosophy at a Catholic college near Bangalore. In his classes he had made it clear that certain truths the Church regarded as beyond doubt were in fact open to question, at least from the standpoint of philosophy, and could be freely discussed. For this he had got into serious trouble, both with the college authorities and with his Jesuit superiors, and in the end he had decided to leave both the Jesuit order and the Church. At one point he had had an interview with the head of the order in India, who told him that if he agreed to stay in the order and in the Church and to keep his ideas to himself, he could have unlimited credit at his wine merchant and unlimited credit with his tailor. I noticed that my visitor was elegantly dressed in sober black. He had not agreed. Instead, he had resigned from the Jesuit order and made it known that he no longer considered himself a member of the Catholic Church. During the next few weeks, he received more than 1,800 abusive and threatening letters. He told me the exact figure, many of them obscene, and some of them from distant parts of India. One night a group of men, in order to discredit him, had tried to introduce a prostitute into the cottage in which he had taken refuge. In desperation, he had fled to Bombay, where Sophia Wadia and other influential friends had secured for him the protection of the police. He was evidently a refined, cultured and sensitive person, and I could see that the experiences he had undergone had left him badly shaken. Well, I said to him, I do not remember. Perhaps all he needed at that time was a sympathetic ear. Nor do I know what happened to him afterwards, though on subsequent visits to Bombay I inquired after him. So the Church has been up to its old tricks, I reflected after my visitor and his bodyguard had left. The Church had been up to its old tricks elsewhere in India too, as I was well aware. Recently, one of the Jesuit fathers of North Point, the Catholic Boys' College in Darjeeling, had gone to the Deputy Commissioner, the senior-most government officer in that part of West Bengal, and reported that I was a communist spy, at the same time suggesting that in the interest of national security, I should be expelled from the Darjeeling district in which Kalimpong was located. Fortunately, I knew the Deputy Commissioner and his wife, and the next time we happened to meet, he told me about the incident. I know very well why he reported you, he added. You have nothing to worry about. The church was up to its old tricks not only in India, but also in South Vietnam. Like its immediate neighbours, Laos and Cambodia, Vietnam was a Buddhist country, though it did not, as they did, follow the Theravada, but the Mahayana in its Chinese form, with a mixture of Chan and Pure Land Buddhism predominating. In the 17th century, French Catholics started missions, and it was not long before the flag followed the cross. Between 1858 and 1884, France conquered Vietnam, and, with Cambodia and Laos, it became part of the French colonial possession of Indochina. After the Second World War, when Vietnam was occupied by the Japanese, France tried to regain control of the territory, being finally defeated at Dien Bien Phu, only after 8 years of bitter fighting. At the 1954 Geneva Conference, the country was divided into communist North Vietnam, led by Ho Chi Minh, with its capital at Hanoi, and pro-Western South Vietnam, led by Ngo Dinh Diem, with its capital at Saigon. President Diem was a Roman Catholic, as was his younger brother Ngo Dinh Nhu, whom he made his personal advisor and put in charge of intelligence and the secret police. His elder brother Ngo Dinh Thuc was Roman Catholic Archbishop of Hue, while his sister-in-law, Madame Nhu, described by her American admirer Claire Booth Luce as, quote, a militant Catholic, led the paramilitary women's organisation. It was therefore not surprising that under the Diem regime, as under French colonial rule, the Catholic minority should have been supported and encouraged, while the less organised Buddhist majority should have been discriminated against, suppressed, and finally systematically persecuted. Things came to a head when, on the 6th of May 1963, the President issued an order prohibiting the Buddhists of Hue from flying the Buddhist flag on the Buddha's birthday, 2 days later, even though a few days earlier, on the occasion of a Catholic festival, the Vatican flag had been flown all over the city. On the 8th of May, their leaders having failed to get the order rescinded, the Buddhists of Hue protested against the ban by going in procession from Tu Dam Pagoda to the Hue radio station. Their government troops broke up the procession with tear gas, then fired on the crowd. 12 people were killed and more than 50 wounded. The Buddhist clergy and laity of South Vietnam then presented the government with 5 requests, namely, 1. That the government rescind the order prohibiting the flying of the Buddhist flag. 2. That Buddhism benefit from the same special treatment granted to the Roman Catholic missions. 3. That the government stop arresting and terrorizing the Buddhists. 4. That the Buddhist clergy and laymen be free to practice their faith and to spread it. And 5. That the government pay equitable compensation for the people killed and punish those responsible in a fitting manner. These requests formed part of a manifesto, the concluding sentence of which read, "We all are ready to sacrifice ourselves until these reasonable requests are granted." Events soon showed Diem and the other members of the Catholic oligarchy that the Buddhists meant what they said. On the 11th of June, a 67-year-old monk burnt himself to death in a crowded Saigon thoroughfare in protest against the government's persecution of the Buddhists. The monk, Thich Quang Duc, struck a match after his saffron robes were drenched with petrol and sat motionless in the meditation posture while the flames enveloped him. Several hundred monks and nuns sat in a circle round the blazing body, chanting and weeping. I was still living in India at the time and well remember the shockwaves that went round the Buddhist world, as well as round India and the West, as reports of the self-immolation and pictures of the burning monk appeared in the newspapers. Only Vietnam's Roman Catholic oligarchy remained unmoved. Madame Nguyen told reporters, "If any more monks want to barbecue themselves, I'll be happy to provide the petrol and a match." More monks did want to barbecue themselves, and in the course of the next few months, as the Diem government declared martial law and a state of siege, desecrated and destroyed major pagodas throughout South Vietnam, arrested and imprisoned thousands of monks and nuns, and held demonstrating students in concentration camps, 8 more monks and 1 nun followed Thich Quang Duc's heroic example. On the 1st of November, the Diem government was overthrown by a long-expected coup d'état in which both the president and his younger brother were killed. Madame Nguyen was then on a lecture tour in the United States, where she assured university audiences that there was no religious persecution in South Vietnam and that Vietnamese Buddhist monks were communists in disguise. On being told of the coup d'état, she angrily accused the United States government and the CIA of being behind it. This was in fact quite true, for Washington had become convinced that by persecuting the Buddhists, Diem was undermining South Vietnam's and the United States' fight against communism. After my return to England in 1964, I was too busy teaching Buddhism and eventually starting a new Buddhist movement to have much time for personal contact with Christians, whether Catholic or Protestant. I did, however, find time to read about Christianity. Besides taking up the thread of my old studies, as I have already related, I read several scholarly volumes on the Eastern Orthodox Church, as well as a few works of popular theology. The most interesting of the latter was the best-selling Honest to God by John A. T. Robinson, then Bishop of Woolwich. It was of interest to me principally on account of the bishop's apparent belief that theism was finished, a view that to my mind pointed in the direction of non-theistic religion, even in the direction of non-theistic Christianity, and thus to a possible overlap between Christianity and Buddhism, of which the bishop seemed not to have heard. I therefore gave my usual Buddhist and quasi-Buddhist audience a lecture on Buddhism and the Bishop of Woolwich. A member of the audience sent a tape recording of the lecture to the bishop, who eventually expressed a desire to meet me. We met at his house, bishops no longer lived in palaces, where we had a long and interesting, though not very deep, discussion in which, Dr. Robinson being an Anglican bishop, his wife also joined. For many years after this encounter, I had no contact with Christians, as far as I remember, other than at the rather unexciting interfaith gatherings that I was occasionally prevailed upon to attend. After handing on my responsibilities as founder of the New Buddhist Movement, which I did in the year 2000, at the age of 75, it occurred to me that I now had time to revisit the interfaith scene. I did this in Birmingham, where I was then living and where I still live. At meetings of the Birmingham Council of Faiths, I met Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, Parsis, followers of the Baha'i faith, Roman Catholics, Protestants and Jews, as well as fellow Buddhists following traditions other than my own. Strange to relate, it was the Roman Catholics who seemed most interested in following up the contacts we had made. Thus I was invited to Oscott College, where I gave a talk on the Buddhist scriptures, was shown Cardinal Newman's rooms at the Birmingham Oratory, which he had founded, attended a mass celebrated by the new Archbishop of Birmingham, whom afterwards I met several times, and attended a reception given by the Archdiocese to the Cardinal Archbishop of Westminster, whom I also met. I even started receiving, each year on the anniversary of the Buddha's attainment of supreme enlightenment, a friendly message from the Vatican, What had happened? Had the Roman Catholic Church experienced a change of heart? Did Roman Catholics no longer have to believe that there was no salvation outside the Church? And what of the past? Did the Church realise that it had been morally wrong for it to preach crusades and condemn heretics to death, and was it now trying to make amends? Or was the Catholic Church's present friendly attitude towards non-Catholics due to the fact that it no longer had any temporal power, and that, in Britain at least, Catholics had been in a minority for several centuries, and therefore were more or less obliged to be friendly? These were the sort of questions I wanted to ask my new friends, but before I knew them well enough to be able to ask them without giving offence, I was struck down by chronic illness, and the questions have remained, for the time being at least, unanswered.